before they fly that airplane by themselves. I had a dental patient come to my office once. He bought a great big motorcycle. He took it out into a vacant lot the first 5 minutes that he bought it, busted up himself, the motorcycle, his teeth, and everything. Humpty Dumpty. Just busted it up. And no insurance, of course, because he just got it. No insurance on the bike, no health insurance. Here's this guy all busted up because he had no idea how to handle that bike. He was a great big man, too, a big strapping fellow, you know, macho. He could handle it. Maybe people should have a little instruction before they take those bikes out and turn them up to 80 miles an hour.
I'm sure you're right, and I know that would happen to me if I ever got on one. That's one thing I'm never going to do. No, I'll not do that. What is the procedure? I know you're not with DMV, but what is the procedure for the endorsement, getting the endorsement on a Class 4? What does a person do? Can you tell me?
There is Dennis Rice is in the audience for motor vehicles. He's with the licensing division, and I think he can answer that better than we can.
Mr. Chairman, Dennis Rice from Motor Vehicles Division. To get a motorcycle endorsement, an applicant has to pass a written test, 25-question multiple-choice test, a vision screening, and then an on-cycle test. We presently use the Motorcycle Safety Foundation's what they call the alternate most test to test the skill, riding skill, that mainly checks the ability to brake and to take evasive action. The two major causes of most motorcycle accidents is the inability of motorcyclists to be able to properly brake and to properly take evasive action. So that's the two things that our test is, you know, really geared to test.
You mean the examiner actually gets on the bike with the...
No, the examiner, it's an off-street test. And the examiner just stands in a position where he can observe.
I was going to say they should get hazard pay if they get on one of those things like Representative Young.
Does every state have an endorsement?
Mm-hmm. Representative Young, all but three.
Okay. Do we have a substantially better safety record because we require an endorsement over states that don't? And if not, then why? Why require the endorsement if it's not serving?
Representative Young, Steve Garrett's from Oregon State University. We do have a better record than those states. If you want to look at the accidents per 1,000 endorsed riders, we do have a better accident record than those states do. You have so many variables when you're figuring accident data. For example, some of the southern states that have a lot of population of military, the army bases in some of the southern states, they have a tremendous accident record, and yet you have to have an endorsement. So it just depends upon the geographical area of the state and the number of riders. Why don't you look that up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, and I might add also that the state of California did a very in-depth study here a few years ago just comparing the quality of two tests. It didn't compare, no test, but they compared the Motorcycle Safety Foundation's MOST test, the Motorcycle Off-Street Skill Test, to a previous test that they had used, which was just sort of a little ride-around-in-circles test. And I think they found that something like the accidents were reduced 20% by those who passed a more difficult skill test.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Aiden.
I read somewhere within the last couple of weeks, I don't remember where, probably most of you read it too, maybe it was in the newspapers, that our system of testing motorcycle riders in the state of Oregon is to send them around the block, and if they come back alive, they get an endorsement.
At one time, that was probably true. Not for about the last 6 or 8 years.
Mr. Chair,
I don't have a problem with the bills or the program, but I think we're to a point eventually where we're going to have to say, is it worth the time and effort and substantial money? I've been away from this committee for a year, but I was shocked that it's $23 or so to get that endorsement, and it would be a shame to have that, be running a $100 a person training program and not be able to show, I think, substantial improvements. I mean, and it sounds like such a good idea that, I mean, you hate to question it, but I think you have to show that it's worth that time and money to in terms of number of accidents and that sort of thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Young, Stan Porter again. We're presently doing a tracking program with our course graduates with the Motor Vehicles Division, and what we're doing is putting in the data of all the course graduates in a control group and comparing those very much like birthdays and things like that, and over a 3 to 5 year period watching the course graduates as compared to people that have not had the course to see what the differences in the records will be. Good. And when that's available, we'll make that public document. And also,
you'll make it public if it's favorable, right?
No matter what. We don't hide things. Also, the Motor Vehicles Division has changed over from one motorcycle test to another test, and I think he can fill you in with the statistics on the people that aren't making it through the test like they used to, which in any motorcycle safety program, there are two components, the courses and a licensing program. And the licensing, which he was talking about around the block, is not a good safety program, and the test that they do have now reflects that in, I think, the increased failure rate, and you have that information.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. The test that Representative Hayden was referring to, where the person went around the block and if they returned without blood on their knees, they passed, the failure rate then was probably about 1 or 2%, you know, pretty small. The failure rate now on our present test is probably about 15%, and the people are having to be more prepared to pass the test accordingly. When they go out on the road to begin their riding, their learning curve time should be reduced because they should be a more skilled rider mm-hmm. when they first take off on the streets by themselves.
We do have information, though, in the state of Oregon regarding those people who have had the education, the course, and those that who have not, even though both have passed the test, the accident rate of those that haven't gone through the course is much higher than those that have. Is that not true?
They don't know yet.
Well, I mean, you told us that 92% of the accidents came from those people who have not had the course.
That quote is from a study that was done, an accident study that was done in Southern California within the confines of Los Angeles, where there was so many thousand accidents, and that was the percentage that came out of that was that 92% of those people did not have treatment,
we don't
even
have
though it was available
to them,
not at the present time.
How long did you say it would be before you thought we...
Another 2 to 3 years. See, we've only been going since 1984, so and that's when we're starting our tracking program. So you need a good 3 to 5 year base to get statistical information from. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you're still very limited with a couple thousand people that we have in that study.
I see.
Mr. Chair,
are we ready?
Ready?
Yes, we're ready. We haven't voted on the amendment.
Okay.
We need to vote on the. We need to vote on the amendment. Again, Representative Young has moved amendments to House Bill 2161 as it engrossed before us. We've had our discussion, so Pamela, if you'll call
Mr.
the roll,
Chairman,
please. Representative Hayden,
would you just read the amendment aloud once, please, before we vote on it?
The amendment is as follows. The proposed amendment submitted by the Traffic Safety Commission on February 17, 1987, and they are, as printed in line, well, there's no lines there. I guess it would be lines 13 through 19 on page 1. Do you want me to read those? And
everybody
that's
got
them.
That, I got
that's,
read
that's the amendment
okay.
to the original.
All right, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, Pamela, will you call the roll, please?
Representatives Peterson?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Brigiotti?
Aye.
Hayden?
Aye.
Jolin?
Aye.
Norris?
Aye.
Witte?
Aye.
Now, motions in order, Representative Young.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2161 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Young moves House Bill 2161 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, Pamela, will you call the roll, please?
Representatives Young?
Aye.
Frigiati?
Aye.
Hayden?
Aye.
Jolin?
Aye.
Norris?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Whitty?
Aye. House Bill 2161 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Now, we will proceed the public hearing on, or work session, on House Bills 2160 and 2161 are closed. And right, we got a, I'll carry 2161 too. I'll assign that also since it's related.
Well, you sure know how to take the hard ones.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm trying to figure out how to get both a motorcycle and a moped on the floor. I don't know how I'm going to do that. Maybe I'll have to get a little model. We'll close the work session this morning and go to public hearings on House Bill 2060. And we have, as our first witness, Doug Gillenscog from the Oregon Highway Division. And who do you have with you this morning? Let's see.
Ken Everett, also right, with the Highway Division.
So if you'll identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Doug Gillenscog, Chief Waymaster for the Oregon State Highway Division. I am pleased to have this opportunity to be here to present House Bill 2060. With me is Ken Everett, Assistant Chief Waymaster. The purpose of this bill is to increase the fines for size and weight violations to where they will be a more effective deterrent against violating size and weight limitations, thereby protecting Oregon's highway system and better protecting the motoring public. Efforts to control the weights of trucks on Oregon highways go back to 1921, when the legislature gave the State Highway Commission the authority to limit weights on any state highway. During the period from October 1922 to September 1924, 5,804 trucks were weighed and 150 citations were issued for overloading. The average fine for an offense was $17.40. This compares with an average fine of $40 in 1984. During this same period, a loaf of bread cost approximately 10 cents. The price of an automobile was under $1,000, and the average cost of a ton of placed paving material was $6. Today, with the cost of a loaf of bread around a dollar, the price of an automobile well in excess of $5,000, and a ton of placed paving material costing an average of $38, the significance of the 1922 fine has been lost. This has resulted in a situation where the fine is no longer an effective deterrent to overloading. In 1981, over 53,000 citations were issued for overweight.
Representative Young.
Chair, just a definition of term. When you say overloading, does that mean that you have more of a load on the vehicle than the vehicle will carry, or you have more of a load on the vehicle than you're licensed to carry?
Representative Young and Mr. Chairman, by that I mean you have more load on the vehicle than the law allows you to have. You can have a maximum of 20,000 on an axle, 34,000 on a tandem. Combinations vary by wheelbase. When you exceed that, you are overloading the truck.
Okay, regardless of what your license to carry.
Yes.
Okay. That helps. Thank
you. In 1981, over 53,000 citations were issued for overweight. To combat this, the 1981 legislature put into law the present fine schedule, and a 37% reduction occurred the following year. This trend continued through 1983, when only about 25,000 citations were issued. The trend then reversed and violations began to increase, with almost 30,000 citations issued in 1986. When DEMA...
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Young.
Is there a difference between overloading and overweight?
Representative Young, Mr. Chairman, no, we would be referring to the same thing.
Okay. Thank you.
When dealing with the overloading of trucks, we must take several things into consideration. First and most important, we must deter trucking companies from overloading in the first place.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hayden.
How would you describe a hay truck that's not overweight but can't get under the telephone wires?
Representative Hayden and Mr. Chairman, that truck would be over height.
That's not overloaded.
No.
In violation too. So you can have over height, over width, overload.
Yes.
Over length.
Yes.
Thank you.
To do this, the fine assessed by our court system must be significant enough to make it undesirable and unprofitable to overload. A recent survey of several dry freight haulers indicates that the average revenue per pound hauled is a little over 7 cents. A recent study by the Center for Transportation Research in Austin, Texas, found that transportation cost, fuel, equipment maintenance, and etc., per mile increase only slightly, while profit increases significantly as cargo weight increases. In the highly competitive trucking industry, overloading can enable an illegal trucker to gain extra profit, lower shipping rates, and enjoy an unfair rate advantage over competing companies. Under our present fine schedule, the maximum fine a carrier can receive is 7 cents a pound. It is clear the incentives may exceed costs, thus making overloading very attractive. Another area we must consider is how much damage is being done to our highway system by overloads. A recent study by the Idaho Department of Transportation concluded that a truck having a 6,000-pound tandem axle overload traveling 180 miles within their state would do $374 worth of damage to the highway system. While our pavements and highway system are not exactly the same as in Idaho, it is likely that if a similar study was conducted in our state, we would arrive at similar conclusions. Our proposed fine schedule would bring the fine assessed more in line with the damage done by overloads. Passage of this bill will also bring our fine closer in line with fines imposed or proposed by our neighboring states. Under our present schedule, a 2,000-pound overload may result in a maximum fine of $21. This same overload in Washington carries a fine of $110, in California $40, and under proposed legislation in Idaho, a fine of $225. Our proposed schedule, one, would increase Oregon's fine to $40. Similarly, a 6,000-pound overload under proposed schedule one would provide for a fine of $360, while in Washington the fine would be $230, California $240, and $550 in Idaho. Mr. Chairman, we have made up three charts that compare our proposed schedule to the present schedule. These three charts cover the schedules number one, schedules number two, and schedules number three. You have copies of these charts in your handout, and they're the last three pages, the three legal size pages.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Thank you. I want to be certain I understand that last paragraph. So you're saying under the new schedule, the proposed schedule, we would be dramatically above the neighboring states. Is that correct?
We would be. Representative Peterson and Chairman Witte, we would be above California and Washington. Under Idaho's proposed legislation, we would be below.
Okay. Thank you.
At this time, I would like to have Ken Everett, the Assistant Chief Weighmaster, explain schedule number one to you on the chart that we have brought.
Before you do that, I would like to ask a question. Now, I know that we don't have scales or anything on completely private roads, and that some, particularly log trucks, carry much heavier loads that wouldn't be legal on the Oregon highways, and as well, they're over width. Is the major reason that they couldn't haul on the highway the fact that they're over width? What I'm wondering is if they
if they were not over with because of the different construction of the trailer and whatever, could they be legal on an Oregon road? And I have a reason for asking.
Yes, if I understand your question right. Yes and no. There's two different ways that loggers haul off highway. Lots of logging companies, for instance, Weyerhaeuser in the Cottage Grove area owns its own highway or road system.
We have the same in Coos County.
The trucks that they buy are built wider, and the stakes on them are often higher than the law allows. So these particular trucks, there's no way that they could haul on a public highway.
I know that, but I'm just, the point of my question, and it's just not a question that popped in my head, the point is that they have to maintain their own road system. And so it would seem to me, I was just wondering, because I drive their road system, I have a pass to go up there and fish and whatever, and the road seems to be in pretty good shape. Yet, most of the traffic on the road is those types of vehicles that aren't legal on Oregon highways. And I know that they have a very thick road surface, but still in all, the facts are that when I get off the county road and onto the Weyerhaeuser road, I'm on a much better road, even though they have overweight vehicles.
Yes.
Is it because of the width and the distribution of the weight, is my question, that they don't do the damage that one would think they would do to their own roads?
I would believe that it would because of the maintenance, the way the highway or the road was built, and the maintenance that they put into the road.
You rarely find a pothole in a Weyerhaeuser road. Rarely. Practically never. And it isn't because they patch them. It must be because of the way they're originally built, I would guess.
Yeah. And I would think that even with the amount of trucks that are coming over these roads, their own log trucks, that oft times we wouldn't have near the traffic that we have on many of our major highways and freeways. A point of example, we're weighing over or close to or over 60,000 trucks a month at our Woodburn facility.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pujati.
Top of page 3 that we held your hand up says 6,000-pound tandem overload traveled 180 miles within their state would do about $374 worth of damage. I question that a little bit. Are you going to be able to explain how you came with that figure?
Representative Brashotti, Mr. Chairman, we do have a copy of the study that Idaho did and would be glad to furnish it to you.
Well, I think what your statement was about the highways and stuff, I think there'd be a tremendous amount of differences in the value of that highway and what the damage was done on the construction. I think you hit the thing right on the head because evidently Weyerhaeuser's prepared roads that they use is a heck of a lot better than the highways that we put together here in our state. So I would still question that even though the study was there. And the other thing is too, just talking about the proposal, you know, a lot of these truckers are having a heck of a time making a living. And if you add any more money onto them, $100 to them might make the break or the, or not. I think this is pretty steep myself.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
To continue our discussion of log trucks, Doug, I think I received, and probably most members of the committee received, a letter from a log truck driver who said that on a landing, depending on whether his trailer was uphill or downhill, or whether maybe the load would be levered like that on an inclined landing, he might weigh legal on the landing, and then when he would get down to a scales or a weigh station, he was overloaded. And maybe 600 pounds of that overload would be mud that he picked up on a mud road. And I'd hate to see a man paying $100 or $1,000 for 600 pounds of mud that he picked up on a road.
Representative Hayden and Mr. Chairman, yes, I've been a waymaster for over 20 years, and I have worked in logging country a good part of that, and they do have those problems. They have scales on both ends of their trucks. It takes a level place, a level landing, in order for these scales to work properly. I know they do have a problem oft times with the person that is the logger themselves building them a level landing or a level place that they can weigh. Unfortunately, as the highway division, once they get down onto state highways, I do not feel that we can accept that responsibility. They still have to be legal. So they need to change their way of operation in order for their scales to work so that they can be legal before they hit our highways. Otherwise, the damage is being done.
Yes, I agree. But even if they do get down to where it's level and they are able to weigh, oftentimes, you know, they find that they are over and there's no way to get that log off. I mean, they'd have to turn around somehow, and that's very difficult, to get back up to the landing where the equipment is there so that the log can be removed, unless there happens to be a peaker that's a very small one, and they could jack it off of there with a, I forget the word. Pardon?
Tweezer.
No, it's I can't think of the name of it now. They use it on the boom a lot. Representative Jolin.
I guess I'll release my load now. I've been trying to calm myself down. I am outraged with this bill. I am totally outraged. And I think you ought to be embarrassed. We're talking about an Oregon comeback here. And yes, loggers, truckers are having a hard time. And no, we shouldn't tolerate overloads. I don't disagree with that. But these fines are outrageous. They are outrageous. And I want to know what in the heck of the cost of a loaf of bread back in 1921 has to do with 1987, realizing that the cost of living, everything has gone up and changed, but that's no justification for these kinds of fee increases. Enough said.
Well said.
That wasn't too bad.
I just had to let it flow. I apologize, Mr. Chair.
With that, we'll proceed to the charts, unless there's a question.
But how does she feel about the proposal?
What do you think about this bill?
Preparing to vote?
Maybe we better go into...
Other than the fee increases, how does it look?
And Mr. Chair, if I may continue a minute now that I've gotten that off my chest and I'm a little bit calmer, and I do apologize. Every now and then I get cranky.
That's all right, Representative Jolin.
I think that...
I walked out of a committee the other day and slammed the door. So
I did that in my first session, as a matter of fact. But, you know, I look at these fines, and I think that these gentlemen, with all due respect, are underrating the amount of these fines. This is a great expense, and they're catching a lot of people. They said in 1986 that should be caught and not tolerated. But 30,000 people. You start multiplying some of these figures that are under current law, and that's a substantial amount of revenue. Just every now and then again, and I can accept the fact, if we're talking about fees and all that, which I have a reluctance to support increases, but I can accept the fact that folks have to do business and they have to pay for the business at hand. But this, to me, is just saying, well, we've got to stop this stuff, so we're going to throw a tremendous fine, and I've heard that the fine is greater than our neighboring states. Do you know that I've talked to a lot of truckers that have said it's getting so expensive to do business in the state of Oregon that they're considering leaving? If we are to come back in this state, we better stop going backwards.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Peterson.
Well, I'm new on this committee, and I don't have biases one way or the other yet. I'm certain I will get them.
You're working on it?
But I do have some questions to ask, and maybe we'll get there in the chart. But if there are some almost 30,000 truckers that are now overloading, and they're paying, what, 7 cents a pound overweight, can you give me a sense of how much you took in terms of overweight violation money the last year, and then how much is estimated it costs to repair roads? I mean, is there any comparison here?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, first, the fine schedule is built on a graduated basis. Not all overloads pay the 7 cents a pound. The 7 cents a pound under the present system doesn't come into play until they're more than 5,000 pounds overloaded.
5,000 pounds?
Yes.
Okay.
This will be explained on one of these charts, too. As far as the amount of money that was collected by fines, I don't have that information. I would be glad to attempt to get it for you.
I appreciate that.
Can we proceed with the charts so we can see what an explanation is in order here on the way these things work? Because I don't really understand. I've been looking at them.
For the record, I'm Ken Everett, Oregon State Highway Division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is Schedule 1. Doug has indicated they are attached to the back of your testimony. I'd like to point out the two axes on the scale. We've had dollar figures over here for $100 increments and the overweight on the bottom of 1,000 pound increments. The proposed fine is in the dotted line, the present fine is in the solid line. Presently, up to 1,000 pounds of overweight is $2 under our present fine system. 1,000 to 2,000 pounds of overweight is $15, and 2,000 to 3,000 pounds of overweight is 1 cent a pound. From 3,000
accident or the road has fallen off or broken up, how do truckers know ahead of time that they have to have their load reduced, that there's a problem before they get there with their overloaded?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, we are required by law to post the highway or road or structure at both ends of the structure and at any interceding roads, any roads that would come onto the road that's been restricted.
Well, I guess I still have trouble. If someone's traveling on a road from out of state and they get to the point where the road is in bad repair and they've been carrying a load for, you know, so many hundreds of miles already, then what do they have to do? Do they physically have to stop and remove some of their load?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, they would either have to do that or normally they would find an alternate route.
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
When we have a bill like this in front of us where you are actually going to be raising revenue when all is said and done, what do you do with that additional revenue? And let me further explain my thinking. This is not revenue that you need to cover your cost necessarily, as are some fees that we tie to the cost of processing paper and etc. What would you do with this extra revenue?
Representative Jolin, Mr. Chairman, this revenue would go back into the general fund to be used to repair highways.
The highway fund?
Or the highway fund, excuse me.
Still dedicated money to highways.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Peterson.
I guess I'm interested in knowing if there's any kind of federal connection with overweight loads. If we're not getting certain amount of federal funds, if we're not abiding by federal laws which connect with state laws, is there any kind of relationship?
Representative Peterson, Mr. Chairman, yes. We are required as the Waymaster unit of the Permits and Waymaster section, and as the Department of Transportation, to do two things each year that I know of on the top of my head for or in response to the Federal Highway Administration. Number one, by the 1st of October each year, we have to submit what we call, or they call, a size and weight plan, a plan of how we are going to control overloads and oversized vehicles here in Oregon. And then number two, we have to certify by the 1st of January each year that we are controlling overloads and overheights and over-dimensional vehicles within Oregon. I am not familiar with the way money exchanges from federal to state, but this does affect the funds that are given the state of Oregon for, from the federal government for highway repair, highway construction.
So do the feds have to okay that plan? I mean, if they don't like it, do you have to go back and do it again?
I have never had one that was not accepted, and I'm not familiar what would happen if that did happen. I could find out
for
you.
I'd be interested in knowing if funds are withheld. Or
Excuse me, Ken Everett says that he has the ability to answer
Mr. that. Chair, Representative Peterson. That is true. Federal funds could be withheld if the federal government failed to approve Oregon's certification.
Steve, you have something to add?
Much of like the sanction would work with speed limits and the compliance. I mean, I'm assuming that this plan and your January reporting is to show that you're in compliance.
Correct.
Secondly, while we talked about road authority and your ability to restrict weights on state highways, who has the responsibility to decide what gets to travel on the interstate? Does the federal government say you do that too? Is this plan a part of the interstate system, your responsibility on the interstate, or do they have some some weight restrictions on the interstate system within this state?
Mr. Chair, yes, it's primarily the interstate is what we're looking at. The federal government does give Oregon funds for to maintain the interstate road system. In turn, they expect that a state will conform to federal weight limits, that we won't allow more than 20,000 pounds on an axle or 34,000 pounds on a tandem axle, and that we will maintain a gross weight primarily of 80,000 pounds. At the same time, that's part of the condition that we also have a size and weight enforcement program to make sure that those laws are obeyed, or otherwise we risk losing the federal dollars.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue, but you do allow them, you know, how do you get to do it under the variance permit system? You know, why do you get to do it if the law says you can't?
The federal government does allow us to issue variance permits, recognizing that there are some items that could not be moved any other way than by permit, and the permit process allows us to control that movement safely so that the machinery or whatever it be can be moved safely with the least inconvenience to the traveling public and without destroying the road that it's going to be traveling on.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But the federal government doesn't set the fines that you must assess.
No, Representative.
And a second question. Were we told the total amount of fines that you would collect in a biennium?
In dollars?
In dollars.
We have the number of violators, 29,000, but we don't know anything about how much revenue is.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we haven't collected that type of information since 1984. It's solely dependent upon the court that citation's put into as to far as what's the disposition of that case, how much fine will be collected. We don't have any current information of what the courts are actually collecting on the citations that we're issuing today. We do have some estimates from 1984, and that was the last time it was sampled. And at that time, the average or the approximate bail that was put on the citation by our enforcement officers was $60. At that same time, the average fine the courts were collecting was $40.
I'm sure we can get that information from the highway people or from Central Services.
Can't he just tell me how much it was in 1984?
If he knows, nice.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we do have some printouts on what happened in 84, but the problem we have there, we only have the information indicates that a part of the citations were still in the system and had not been processed through. We do have some records that show about 18,000 of them of what the fines that were collected, just as total figures.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Young, I think you had a question. Did you have a question?
I think I do. Why don't you go on and
all right, Representative Norris.
This might have been answered a little bit ago, but if I'm a trucker and I'm loaded up in Portland and I've got to get over to Montana and I'm going to go from Portland and Oregon through Spokane, across over northern Idaho and into Montana, Do I know that every one of those states have the same permissible maximum load, so when I start legal in Portland that I can feel secure I'm legal all the way to Missoula?
Representative Norris, Mr. Chairman, no, every state has different weight laws. And so it is the responsibility for a trucker or a trucker company to know the laws of the state that they are going to travel through.
What was said earlier about recognition of the federal hope for limits at least? Somebody mentioned a figure of 80,000 pounds. Is that a federal standard?
Representative Norris, Mr. Chairman, to the best of my knowledge, all the states would be 20,000 on an axle, 34 on a tandem. It's where you run into gross weight that you would possibly run into some differences.
Well, wouldn't a matter of multiplication times the number of axles sort of figure out what that gross weight would be?
Gross weight.
You've got a standard acceptable limit per axle or per double axle?
Gross weights are not only regulated by the axle and the single axles, but they're regulated by the wheelbase of groups and of the combination, so that you can control how much weight is going across bridges and structures in certain areas of the bridge and structure. I am not sure that all states use the same formula.
Doug, is there a multi-state agreement that we're involved with, Oregon and other states, that would solve this problem or is in the process of?
Representative Witte, yes, there's a multi-state committee. And Tom Brad, who is here today to testify on House Bill 2061, is on this committee. He could possibly enlighten you as to what they are accomplishing or attempt to accomplish.
Fine. Well, we'll get to that then at that point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Young, you found your question.
Yes.
Good.
Well, I didn't find my answer.
Oh.
Okay, under at the last part of Section 2, it raises from a Class C to a Class B misdemeanor.
$6,000.
It's for failure to comply with commercial vehicle enforcement requirements. Would be a Class B misdemeanor. But what was the purpose for making that a severe penalty? And when would they be subject to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Young.
That's on page 3 on line 12.
To the best of our knowledge, raising it from a Class C to a B misdemeanor was so that the bail itself could be increased, too, or the fine could be increased for that violation. This is
then. Did you correct that under your amendments to increase the bail? You have amendments to increase the bail amounts, right?
Yes, Representative. Under the amendments to the bail, there was no necessity under the amendments to change this portion of it.
Okay. Is the reason that you're having trouble, you want to increase the penalty so you can increase the bail because people are failing to show and just forfeiting bail?
Chair, Representative Young. No, that's just, the problem goes back to what Representative Hayden asked earlier. It's people that refuse to come into the scales. If they're hauling enough load that the fine for refusing to come in or refusing to weigh is less than the fine would be for the overload that they're hauling, oftentimes they will go that route with it.
Okay, but it says that it's in addition. Says the penalty provided under this subsection is in addition to any penalty provided for violation of any prohibition relating to vehicle weight, size, load, conformation, or equipment. So this is on top of of whatever possible violation there might be there. And wouldn't you assume that, it would, you would have an opportunity to fine for both?
As I understand your question, what this is saying, at least in our understanding of it, is that it allows us to issue the citation if their driver refuses to come into a scale, if he is over height, or if we can in some way ascertain that he is actually overweight. We could issue both the citation for the overweight or the size violation and for the failure to come in.
Okay, but the Mr. Chair, the failure, on line 32, failure or refusal to stop for and submit to measurement or weighing is 350 presently, right?
500.
On line 32, it says $350 on page 2.
Yes, Representative, that's by statute.
Okay, then what I'm trying to tie in is, what is changing from Class C to Class B? How do those relate? Is changing to a Class B simply to make it so that you can go to $1,000?
Representative Young and Mr. Chairman, yes, that is the reason. The ceiling on a Class C is not high enough to go to $1,000.
Then one more question.
Representative Young.
Under Section 3, then it's a cumulative type thing. The first violation is so much, second so much, and the third.
Representative Young, Mr. Chairman, yes, that's how it would work. This would have to be kept track of by the courts themselves.
And this is in addition to whatever actual fine there might be for the first violation, the second violation, and the third violation.
You're talking about over height and over width in this case.
Or is that just a flat?
Yeah, it would be flat. The first violation, you would receive the flat $150. Okay, the second violation, then you could receive the provisions of the second violation, the flat fine. It would not be the $150 plus another what the second provision allows.
Okay, I'll check that, but it seems to me that in checking 118.060.090 and 340, that covers a lot of things other than the height and weight, height and width limit.
Yes, all other violations covered under that would be $100 with no graduation.
Yeah.
For the committee's benefit, a Class A misdemeanor is 1 year, maximums 1 year in jail, $2,500 fine. B is 6 months, $1,000, and C is 30 days, $500. Those are the way the categories
run. Okay, and one other clarification.
Representative Young.
On that Section 3, that is on the owner of the, can be on the owner of the vehicle, not on the driver, operator.
Representative Young, Mr. Chairman, yes.
And so you could have 30 rigs out on the road and you'd get to three pretty quick. Three violations.
Representative Young, Mr. Chairman, not as I understand it. It would be kept on the driver, not on the company in this case. When a driver appears for the citation, through the legal system, the driver would have to make a plea of co-defendant in order to bring the owner into it. So if a particular driver got one over height violation and then through the court system pled co-defendant to bring the owner in, they could do that under the second offense and the third offense. This would be done through the court system. We always cite the driver. Does that answer your question?
It may, but it says here that part of it, one offense is if you're driving the vehicle, the other if you own a vehicle or a combination of vehicles. And causes or permits a vehicle or a combination of vehicles to be driven. So it seems to me you could have a fleet of 30 trucks, and these could keep piling up against you for things that your drivers did in terms of not getting the proper load on. But maybe it's something I've just got to go back and look at.
Any further questions of these gentlemen? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, just a moment.
I have one more thing.
Well, let's have a question from Representative Hayden.
Well, I'm just curious that if we don't know how much fine is being collected, how do we know we need more? That's rhetorical, I guess.
I don't know if the purpose is to collect money or prevent overloads is the purpose, primarily.
Representative Hayden and Mr. Chairman, we as the Waymasters in the Highway Division, that would really be our ultimate success, is if we could stop overloading. That's what this bill is designed to do, deter overloading.
I think I should ask this, and I was thinking about this earlier, with the lumber economy returning a little more towards normalcy, are there more trucks on the road now than there was 2 years ago or 4 years ago, would you say?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to say yes, there is.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you very much. We have a request from John Nix that he be allowed to testify next, since he has to go to probably back to work. So if John's here, I'll have him next.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Joel.
Is John a truck driver?
Have been.
Good.
If you'll identify yourself, John, then proceed.
My name is John Nix, Jr. from Albany, Oregon. I am the owner of Nix Transportation, president, manager. I've been a permit holder in the state of Oregon hauling logs and lumber since 1946. I would not like to get up here today and say anything derogatory about the Waymasters, because I think they've done a terrific job through the years. But there is no way that the trucking industry, coming from myself, I operate about 25 trucks, three of those are loggers, the others are flatbeds that haul lumber products and building materials. There's no way that we can stand to pay any more taxes. Last month alone, just our new highway use tax to our little company, some 20 trucks that operated in January, it amounted to an additional $1,050 in highway use tax.
That's your weight mile.
Weight mile, highway use tax.
Thank you.
Excuse me, that was for 1 month?
That was for 1 month. The month of January, and it was a very slow month for us. We can't pay more fines. The company themselves doesn't send the drivers out to overload. And I think that's one of our big problems. You get a driver out and he overloads, and the ticket is made out to the driver, but if the driver does not pay this ticket, it comes back to the company and they have to pay it, or they would lose their permit, operating permit. The only way that I see that we can stop the overloading is to get some kind of a rate set and haul all of our products by weight. As it is now, there's no rates, and a person goes out there and if they can haul a 5 or 10,000 pound overload, that's profit to them. Maybe. Most of the legitimate people legitimate operators do not do these kinds of things. Our trucks, speaking of our company, we weigh 99% of our loads at a private scale someplace before we cross the state scales. And I'm not going to say that we don't have a few overloads. But if we had one that was 5,000 pounds overloaded, he would most definitely legalize that load before he ever traveled up and down the state highways, and especially for the knowledge of anybody in our office. We just can't stand any more taxes. And like I say, I've been hauling logs since 1946, and we had a very good judge over in Toledo, Oregon, Earl Conrad. For many years, he fought with the Highway Department when they started putting so many cents per pound on overloads. And Earl used to say, like I heard this morning here, that this is a court of law. We're not selling bread or bananas. We are leveling fines, and we don't level it by weight. I think that still holds true today. Like I said in the beginning, I don't want to say anything derogatory about the Waymasters, because I think they've done a terrific job. They've worked with the truckers. Our scales are now open so that any trucker can check his weight at any time. And I think that's a big boon to us. I think one of our other faults, that we have certain instances where we'll weigh on a set of scales and go down the road 40 or 50 miles, and we were legal at the first set of scales, and come to the next set of scales, and we're 2,000 pounds overloaded. There again, you go in and you talk to these people, and there's a personality conflict. The person that's weighing at the second set of scales shows that you're overloaded, and he's just doing his job. We can't.
John, can I ask you? You get something showing what your weight was on the first.
No.
You don't get anything?
No.
So there's no evidence that you've been weighed by a state weighmaster at the first four?
No.
There isn't?
No. And years ago, we used to get you'd weigh at the first set of scales, and you'd get a little ticket. You could take it to the second set of scales or how many other scales you had in your route. But to my knowledge, they don't do this anymore. I know of several instances in the past summer where trucks were weighed on the coast and they got into inland scales and they were overloaded.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jolan.
John, and thank you for coming today to kind of put things into perspective. I have a general question for you, and I had mentioned it earlier. I've talked to a lot of people in my district and surrounding areas who drive truck, whether they're independent owners or whatever. Really doesn't make a difference when I hear the comment. That is that they are saying that it is getting more expensive to be a trucker or to have a fleet of trucks, whatever it may be, in the state of Oregon than some of our states in close proximity.
That is true.
And what causes that? Is it a combination of a lot of different things? Or
our highway use tax is very high here. Our PUCs, let's call it for simplicity.
Is that higher than California or Washington, for example?
It figures out much higher the way I figured. I run 11 western states with part of our trucks. And our highway use tax is much higher in Oregon than it is in the combining states. Even though we pay a larger license fee at the beginning of the year, and we pay a lesser one in the state of Oregon, it costs us much more to operate in the state of Oregon than it does in California or Nevada or Idaho.
How do you feel about that, John?
Well, I guess I've spent many years up here trying to get things done about it and never have succeeded, but I'm still not going to give up. I keep trying to get it reduced somehow.
If I might, per mile.
Pardon?
Per mile.
Per mile.
It costs more in Oregon, and that would have to be per mile. Right?
Per mile, right.
Right. And in any other state, excuse me, if I might just ask another one, and then you can continue, okay?
Okay.
Do you have the weight mile system in any of the other 10 states outside of Oregon?
No.
Yes,
not on the same basis, excuse
right.
me.
Thank you.
I just kind of want to make a comment now that I've calmed myself down a little bit. And I apologize to everybody earlier on where I kind of just blew a lot of steam, but sometimes that has to come out. I just can't hold myself back. We have an enforcement program. In most cases, we have reasonably substantial fines. The increases, in my opinion, are arbitrary. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I guess I should have asked of the earlier witnesses is, who came up with these figures? You know, what are the reasons behind it? Some of the questions that Representative Young asked of the compiled effect of some of these fines and bail and all that. I'm traveling down the same road you are. I see kind of the double and possible triple whammy effect in some cases. Personally, I think this is an unreasonable request established in this bill, and I just want to be noted as a no vote if we ever come to a work session.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Young.
Yeah.
The problem, sir, what is your solution to it? The problem as I see it is that you have a relatively low fine for a relatively low overweight. And then both under the, well, even more so under the proposal, we're really going to sock it to people that go substantially overweight. If we don't do that, what do we do as a deterrent? Because apparently it pays to be a little overweight.
Can I give you my theory on that?
Yes.
I feel as though a man that's loading up 1,000 pounds in my company, I'm saying, if he's 1,000 pounds over or close to it, I think he's doing a very good job. If he's 5,000 pounds over, he's a violator. And no matter what we do with our fines, we aren't going to stop the violators out there. There are people that ran through the state of Oregon 15 years ago that hauled 100,000 pounds from here to Nevada and Utah, and I know it personally. These people that are violators are going to violate no matter what our fines are, and they aren't going to get caught.
Okay, one question, and maybe I should ask it to them. What about just simply saying if you're overweight, you do not move until you're in compliance with the weight system? And to heck with the fines and all of that, just simply say if you're 1,000 pounds overweight or whatever the break is, that fine, it just sits there until that problem is taken care of or until you pay a subsidy.